Forgotten Classics, where a good story never goes out of style.
Hello, everyone. I'm Julie, and here we have episode 113 of Forgotten Classics, The End of Breaking Point by James Gunn. First, however, I have a podcast highlight for you that I'm so excited about. It's actually not a podcast, but it is downloadable and it is free, so we're going to count that. Because I'm a little more freeform here than some people in their podcast reviews, right? A lot of people have heard of this, and for them, here's a hint. It's nighttime in the big city. And for everybody else, like me, who'd never heard of it until someone else told them about it, I will tell you it is Bob Dylan's theme time radio hour. And this is the most amazing show you've ever heard. It was a one-hour satellite radio show that Bob Dylan hosted, and it was originally on the air from 2006 and ended in 2009. And each episode is about as close to the really old style of having the best DJ you can imagine play you the most eclectic mix of music, all interspersed with corny jokes, old radio promos, listener phone calls, email readings. And he especially comments a lot on the music and the musicians, and a lot of information also about the different themes. And the themes are one of the main things that makes it so great, besides Bob Dylan, of course, which is that it's the most eclectic group of themes you can imagine. Baseball, coffee, jail, the telephone, counting down, which in that one they, from 10 to 0, they played songs that had the numbers in them. Shoes, Texas, well, okay, come on, gotta have songs about Texas. Trains, there were so many songs about trains, they had to have two shows about trains. But you expect that, right? Locks and keys, doctors, cats, guns, sugar, candy, street maps. I mean, to tell you. And the first season had 50 shows. The second two seasons each had 25. So that's 100 or close to 100. They repeated 5 or 6 shows in different seasons. But that's 100 hours of pure entertainment. The thing that really makes this great is that most of these songs were from Bob Dylan's own record collection. They don't play the music that he wrote or sang, but they're playing other artists. And so you've got old country and western, old blues, new artists who he's met or listens to. Of course, rock and roll, folk, bebop, R&B, you know, imagine a style. And when you think about those themes, they all go around the themes. So that just leaves you wide open. Now, as I've mentioned time and time again, I'm not listening to spoken word, but this is not spoken word. It's like the best radio ever. Usually we will listen to these when we are on car rides together because we've all heard them once or so, or most of them. But there's something for everyone in these. And a lot of times these themes or some of the information in the themes will bring up wonderful conversational points, especially when, you know, your kids are college age like ours are. But I have to say, I've been playing it around the house because it's like the old days before everything was driven by top 40s. And with that in mind, they still try to harken back to that old feeling. The introduction, which I'm going to play you a sample of in a minute, harkens back to that. It always starts off, it's nighttime in the big city. It's done by Ellen Barkin. But after that, the details are different, and the music underlying it is different to go into the theme. Take a listen.
It's nighttime in the big city. Outside, the dogs are barking. A woman walks barefoot, her high heels in her handbag. It's theme time radio hour with your host, Bob Dylan.
¶¶ It's time for Theme Time Radio Hour. And tonight, we're going to be talking about the most beautiful things on Earth. The fine-smelling, colorful, bee-tempting world of flowers. The bougainvillea, the passion flower, the butterfly chlorodendron, the angel's trumpets, the firecracker plant. We're going to be talking about Rosa rugosa, the angel face, all that jazz. Double the light, the Gemini, and the Julia Child. We're going to be talking about the knockout shrub, the new dawn, the Mr. Lincoln. And that's only the roses. We're also going to hit on the Silver King, the German status, the globe thistle, and the Joe Pye weed, the violet, the daisy, the lovely chrysanthemum, the yarrow, and the tansy. We'll be hitting on the bachelor's button, the cock's comb, and the lion's ear, the loving a mist, and the victorious sorghum. I just made that one up. We're going to be talking about flowers on Theme Time Radio Hour.
And the reason I'm bringing all this up is, although it was on satellite radio, there is an unofficial Theme Time Radio Hour archive where you can download all the episodes. We actually had them because Tom was able to listen to XM Radio free through his AOL subscription for a while. So he got the first two seasons that way, and he was never at work when they were playing it, which is where the subscription came in, through that computer. So he would record it onto his computer, and we then, as is our way, wound up passing the recordings around the family and taking them on trips and things like that with us. But there is another easier way now, and that's also how we got season 3, which is this archive. Each one comes in as a zipped file of that episode, and when you unpack it, it's got 20 to 30 segments in it. So you'll have the introduction, you'll have a song, him talking. There is software that you can get that puts it all together into one episode, and that's what we use, and I'll put a link to that. It's free software. It only takes about 5 minutes, no big deal. Or you can also do what Rose prefers, which is just to leave it in the segments, because she likes to be able to skip songs if she doesn't like them. Me? I used to like to skip those songs, but now I kind of have gotten to the point where I like to listen to them. It kind of pushes that envelope again of stuff that I used to not like that I need to be exposed to, maybe. So I don't mind it. At any rate, I'll put a link to the software on there. And I have to say, Bob Dylan, you do feel like you get to know him. He will do anything. You haven't really heard the poem Annabel Lee until you've heard him read it. I think it was in the segment on women's names. But it just takes on a whole new tone. And he tells the corniest jokes. And just since this is a short one, and I have that segment from downloading it, I'm going to play a bit for you. Here you go. Take a listen.
Sometimes if it sounds like everyone's laughing, maybe they're not. Maybe it's canned laughter. Canned laughter is a laugh track that uses the artificial sound of audience laughter, often pre-recorded and inserted into TV comedy shows. The first TV show to incorporate a laugh track was The Hank McCune Show in 1950. Nowadays, laugh tracks aren't used that much. I was at the golf course and I ran into Chuck Lorre, who created the TV shows Sybil, Grace Under Fire, and 2½ Men. I asked him if he ever used canned laughter.
Actually, Bob, there's no canned laughter on 2½ Men or any of the shows I've shot. They're all done in front of a live studio audience, so the sound you hear after those jokes, that's real people laughing. If there's anything unusual that you might hear, it's the same guy laughing all the time at every joke on every show, and that's me, and it's not so much laughing as the loud shriek of relief that the audience is laughing. You might want to use a 7-iron there. Oh, nice shot.
You know, I wonder if canned laughter would sound good on Theme Time Radio Hour. Let's give it a try. Hey, not yet. 3 out of 5 people go to psychiatrists. The other 2 are psychiatrists. I was at a restaurant. I said to the waiter, "There's a needle in my soup." He said, "I'm very sorry. It's a typographical error. It's supposed to be a noodle." Well, I don't know if that's going to work for me.
Well, I think you get the idea. I highly encourage you to go check out the archive, and I'll put a link also to the Wikipedia page and to a few other resources. Enjoy it. Try one, especially if you drive around much. You're going to really love it. Okay, enough of that. Back to the story. Things were not in very good shape when last we saw the crew. Two people were unconscious. Hoskins seems to be almost in a catatonic state, staring at his chessboard. And we're left with the captain and Parisi, who are getting increasingly frustrated, both with the situation and, I think, with each other, too, because it's down to them. And who wouldn't be freaking out in that situation, huh? I know. So, let's not put it off. Come on. I'll meet you on the other side. Breaking Point by James Gunn. This work is in the public domain. 6. For man's sense is falsely asserted to be the standard of things. On the contrary, all the perceptions, both of the senses and the mind, bear reference to man and not to the universe. And the human mind resembles those uneven mirrors which impart their own properties to different objects and distorts and disfigures them. For every one has a cave or den of his own which refracts and discolors the light of nature. Sir Francis Bacon, 1561-1626. It was the captain who moved first. He went to the remaining bulkhead, spun a dog, and opened a cabinet. From it he took a rack of spare radar parts and three thick coils of wire. Parisi, startled, turned, and saw Hoskins peering owlishly at the captain. Anderson withdrew some tools, reached far back in the cabinet, and took out a large bottle. "Oh," said Parisi, "that. I thought you were doing something constructive." In the far shadows, Hoskins turned silently back to his game. The captain gazed down at the bottle, tossed it, caught it. "I am," he said. "I am." He came and sat beside the doctor. He thumbed off the stopper and drank ferociously. Parisi watched, his eyes as featureless as the imprisoning dark. "Well?" said the captain pugnaciously. Parisi's hands rose and fell once. "Just wondering why." "Why I'm going to get loopin' stoopin' drunk? I'll tell you why, head shrinker. Because I want to, that's why. Because I like it. I'm doing something I like because I like it. I'm not doing it because of the inversion of this concealed repression as expressed in the involuted feelings my childhood developed in my attitude toward the sex life of beavers. See, couch catechizer, old boy. I like it, and that's why. I knew a man who went to bed with old shoes because he liked it," said Parisi coldly. The captain drank again and laughed harshly. "Nothing can change you, can it, Nick?" Parisi looked around him almost fearfully. "I can change," he whispered. "Ives is gone. Give me the bottle." Something clattered to the deck at the hem of the black curtain. "It's another hallucination," said the captain. "Go pick up the hallucination, Nicky boy."
"Not my hallucination," said Parisi. "Pick it up yourself."
"Sure," said the captain good-naturedly. He waited while Parisi drank, took back the bottle, tilted it sharply over his mouth. He wiped his lips with the back of his hand, exhaled heavily, and went to the blackness across the cabin. "Well, what do you know?" he breathed. "What is it this time?" Anderson held the thing up. "A trophy, that's what." He peered at it. "All-American, 2675. Little statue of a guy holding up a victory wreath. Nice going, little guy." He strode to Parisi and snatched away the bottle. He poured liquor on the head of the figurine. "Have a drink, little guy." "Let me see that." Parisi took it, held it, turned it over. Suddenly he dropped it as if it were a red-hot coal. "Oh, dear God." "'Smatter, Nick?" The captain picked up the statuette and peered at it.
"Put it down. Put it down," said the doctor in a choked voice. "It's Johnny."
"Oh, it is, it is," breathed the captain. He put down the statuette gingerly on the table, hesitated, then turned its face away from them. With abrupt animation, he swung to Parisi. "Hey, you didn't say it looked like Johnny. You said it was Johnny."
"Did I?"
"Yep," he grinned wolfishly. "Not bad for a psychologist. What a peephole you opened up. Graven images, huh?"
"Shut up, Anderson," said Parisi tiredly. "I told you I'm not going to let you needle me."
"Ah, now it's all in fun," said the captain. He plumped down and threw a heavy arm across Anderson's shoulders. "Let's be friends. Let's sing a song." Parisi shoved him away.
"Leave me alone. Leave me alone."
Anderson turned away from him and regarded the statuette gravely. He extended the bottle toward it, muttered a greeting, and drank. "I wonder." The words hung there until Parisi twisted up out of his forlorn reverie to bat them down.
"Damn it, what do you wonder?"
"Oh," said the captain jovially, "I was just wondering what you'll be."
"What are you talking about?"
Anderson waved the bottle at the figurine, which called it to his attention again, and so again he drank. "Johnny turned into what he thinks he is, a little guy with a big victory. Hoskins there, he's going to be a slide rule, just you wait and see. Old Ives, that's easy. He's going to be a beer barrel with beer in it. Always did have a head on him, Ives did." He stopped to laugh immoderately at Parisi's darkening face. "Me? I have no secrets no more. I'm going to be a coat of arms, a useless philosophy rampant on a field of stars." He put the open mouth of the bottle against his forehead and pressed it violently, lowered it, and touched the angry red ring it left between his eyes. "Mark of the beast," he confided. "Cast mark. Zero, that's me, and my whole damn family. The die is cast. The cast has died." He grunted appreciatively, and turned again to Parisi. "But what's old Nicky going to be?"
"Don't call me Nicky," said the doctor testily.
"I know," said the captain, narrowing his eyes and laying one finger alongside his nose. "A reference book. That's what you'll be. A treatise on the post-nasal hysterectomy, or how to unbutton a man's prejudices and take down his pride. I swiped all that from somewhere." "No," he shouted suddenly. Then, with conspiratorial quiet, he said, "You won't be no book, Nicky boy. Covers aren't hard enough. Not the right typeface. Get it?" He roared and dug Parisi viciously in the ribs. "Typeface. It's a witticism." Parisi bent away from the blow like a caterpillar being bitten by a fire ant. He said nothing. "And finally," said the captain, You won't be a book because you got no spine. He leapt abruptly to his feet. Well, what do you know? He bent and scooped up an unaccountable object that rested by the nearest shadows. It was a quarter keg of beer. He hefted it and thumped it heavily down on the table. Come on, Nick, he chortled. Gather ye round. Here's old Ives, like I said. Parisi stared at the keg. His eyes stretched so wide open that the lids moved visibly with his pulse. Stop it, Anderson, you swine. The captain tossed him a disgusted glance and a matching snort. From the clutter of radar gear, he pulled a screwdriver and a massive little step-down transformer down on its handle. The bung disappeared explosively inside the keg and was replaced by a gout of white foam. Parisi shrieked. Ah, shut up, growled Anderson. He rummaged until he found a tube shield. He stripped off a small length of self-welding metal tape and clapped it over the terminal hole at the closed end of the shield, making it into an adequate mug. He waited a moment while the weld cooled, then tipped the keg until solid beer began to run with the foam. He filled the improvised mug and extended it toward Parisi. Good old Ives, he said sentimentally. Come on, Parisi, have a drink on Ives. Parisi turned and covered his face like a frightened woman. Anderson shrugged and drank the beer. It's good beer, he said. He glanced down at the doctor, who suddenly flung himself face down across the couch with his head hanging out of sight on the opposite side, from which came the sounds of heaving and choking. Poor old Nick, said the captain sadly. He refilled the mug and sat down. With his free hand he patted Parisi's back. Can't take it. Poor, poor old Nick. After that, there was a deepening silence, a deepening blackness. Parisi was quiet now, breathing very slowly, holding each breath, expelling air, and lying quiet for full 3 seconds before each inhalation, as if breathing were a conscious effort. More, as if breathing were the whole task, the entire end of existence. Anderson slumped lower and lower. Each time he blinked, his lids opened a fraction less, while the time his eyes stayed closed became a fraction of a second longer. The cabin waited as tensely as the taut pose of the rigid little victory trophy. Then there was the music. It was soft, grand music. The music of pageantry, cloth of gold and scarlet vestments, pendant jewels and multicolored dimness shouldering upward to be lost in vaulted stone. It was music which awaited the accompaniment of whispers, thousands of odd ritualistic sibilants which would carry no knowable meaning and only one avowed purpose. Soft music. Soft. Soft, but not soft as to volume, for the volume grew and grew, but soft with the softness of clouds, which are soft for all their mountain size and brilliance, soft and living as a tiger's throat, soft as a breast, soft as the act of drowning, and huge as a cloud. Anderson made 2 moves. He raised his head, and he spun the beer in his mug so its center surface sank and the bubbles whirled. With his head up and his eyes down, he sat watching the bubbles circle and slow. Parisi rose slowly and went to the center of the small lighted space left to them, and slowly he knelt. His arms came up and out, and his upturned face was twisted and radiant. Before him in the blackness there was, or perhaps there had been for some time, a blue glow, almost as lightless as the surrounding dark, but blue and physically deep for all that. Its depth increased rather than its light. It became the ghost of a grotto, the mouth of a nameless place. And in it was a person, a presence. It beckoned. Parisi's face gleamed wetly. "Me?" he breathed. "You want me?" It beckoned. "I don't believe you," said Parisi. "You can't want me. You don't know who I am. You don't know what I am, what I've done. You don't want me." His voice quavered almost to inaudibility. "Do you?" It beckoned. "Then you know," sang Parisi in the voice of revelation. "I have denied you with my lips, but you know, you know. You know that underneath, deep down, I have not wavered for a moment. I have not wavered for an instant. I have kept your image before me." He rose. Now Anderson watched him. "You are my life," said Parisi. "My hopes, my fulfillment. You are all wisdom and all charity. Thank you, Master. I give thee thanks, O Lord," he blurted, and walked straight into the blue glow. There was an instant when the music was an anthem, and then it, too, was gone. Anderson's breath whistled out. He lifted his beer, checked himself, then set it down gently by the figurine of the athlete. He went to the place where Parisi had disappeared, bent and picked up a small object. He swore and came back to the couch. He sucked his thumb and swore again. "Your thorns are sharp, Parisi." Carefully, he placed the object between the beer keg and the statuette. It was a simple wooden cross. Around the arms and shaft, twisted tightly and biting deeply into the wood, was a thorny withe. "God almighty, Nick," Anderson said mournfully. "You didn't have to hide it. Nobody'd have minded." "Well," he roared suddenly at the darkness, "what are you waiting for? Am I in your way? Have I done anything to stop you? Come on, come on." His voice rebounded from the remaining bulkhead, but was noticeably swallowed up in the absorbent blackness. He waited until its last reverberations had died, and then until its memory was hard to fix. He pounded futilely at the couch cushions, glared all about in a swift, intense animal way. Then he relaxed, bent down, and fumbled for the alcohol bottle. "What's the matter with you out there?" he demanded quietly. "You waiting for me to sober up? You want me to be myself before you fix me up? You want to know something? In vino veritas, that's what. You don't have to wait for me, kiddies. I'm a hell of a lot more me right now than I will be after I get over this." He took the figurine and replaced it on the other side of the keg. "That's right, Johnny. Get over on the other side of old beer belly there. Make room for the old man." To the blackness he said, "Look, I got neat habits. Don't leave me on no deck here. Rack me up alongside the boys. What is it I'm going to be? Oh, yeah, a coat of arms. Hey, I forgot the motto. All righty. This is my motto. Sic itur ad astra. That is to say, this is the way to the men's room." Somewhere, a baby cried. Anderson threw his forearm over his eyes. Someone went, "Shh," but the baby went right on crying. Anderson said, "Who's there?"
"Just me, darling."
He breathed deeply twice and then whispered, "Louise?"
"Of course."
"Shh, Jeannie." "Jeannie's with you, Louise? She's all right? You're all right?"
"Come and see,"
the sweet voice chuckled. Captain Anderson dove into the blackness aft. It closed over him silently and completely. On the table stood an ivory figurine, a quarter keg of beer, a thorny cross, and a heart. It wasn't a physiological specimen. Rather, it was the archetype of the most sentimental of symbols, the balanced, cushiony, brilliant red Valentine heart. Through it was a golden arrow, and on it lay cut flowers, lilies, white roses, and forget-me-nots. The heart pulsed strongly, and though it pumped no blood, at least it showed that it was alive, which made it perhaps a better thing than it looked at first glance. Now it was very quiet in the ship, and very dark. 7. We are about to land. The planet is green and blue below us, and the long trip is over. It looks as if it might be a pleasant place to live. A fragment of Old Testament verse has been running through my mind, from Ecclesiastes, I think. I don't remember it verbatim, but it's something like this. To everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under heaven, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to get and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted. For me, anyway, I feel that the time has come. Perhaps it is not to die, but something else, less final or more terrible. In any case, you will remember, I know, what we decided long ago, that a man owes one of two things to his planet, to his race, posterity or himself. I could not contribute the first. It is only proper that I should offer the second and not shrink if it is accepted. From a letter by Peter Hoskins to his wife. In the quiet and the dark, Hoskins moved. "Checkmate," he said. He rose from his chair and crossed the cabin. Ignoring what was on the table, he opened a drawer under the parts cabinet and took out a steel rule. From a book rack he took down a heavy manual. He sat on the end of the couch with the manual on his knees and leafed through it, smoothing it open at a page of physical measurements. He glanced at the floor, across it to the black curtain, back to the one exposed bulkhead. He grunted, put the book down, and carried his tape to the steel wall. He anchored one end of it there by flipping the paramagnetic control on the tape case and pulled the tape across the room. At the blackness, he took a reading, made a mark. Then he took a fore and aft measurement from a point opposite the forward end of the table to one opposite the after end of the bunk. Working carefully, he knelt and constructed a perpendicular to this line. He put the tape down for the third time, arriving again at the outboard wall of darkness. He stood regarding it thoughtfully, then, unhesitatingly, plunged his arm into it. He fumbled for a moment, moving his hand around in a circle, pressing forward, trying again. Suddenly there was a click, a faint hum. He stepped back. Something huge shouldered out of the dark. It pressed forward toward him, past him, stopped moving. It was the port. Hoskins wiped sweat away from his upper lip and stood blinking into the airlock until the outer port opened as well. Warm afternoon sunlight and a soft, fresh breeze poured in. In the wind was birdsong and the smell of growing things. Hoskins gazed into it, his mild eyes misty. Then he turned back to the cabin. The darkness was gone. Ives was sprawled on the after couch, apparently unconscious. Johnny was smiling in his sleep. The captain was snoring stertorously, and Parisi was curled up like a cat on the floor. The sunlight streamed in through the forward viewports. The manual wheel gleamed on the bulkhead, unbroken. Hoskins looked at the sleeping crew and shook his head, half smiling. Then he stepped to the control console and lifted a microphone from its hook. He began to speak softly into it in his gentle, unimpressive voice. He said, "Reality is what it is, and not what it seems to be. What it seems to be is an individual matter, and even in the individual it varies constantly. If that's a truism, it's still the truth, as true as the fact that this ship cannot fail. The course of events after our landing would have been profoundly different if we had unanimously accepted the thing we knew to be true. But none of us need feel guilty on that score. We are not conditioned to deny the evidence of our senses. What the natives of this planet have done is at base simple and straightforward. They had to know if the race who built this ship could do so because they were physiologically sound, and therefore capable of reasoning out the building process among many, many other things, or whether we were merely mechanically apt. To find this out, they tested us. They tested us the way we test steel, to find out its breaking point. And while they were playing a game for our sanity, I played a game for our lives. I could not share it with any of you, because it was a game only I, of us all, have experience in. Parisi was right to a certain degree when he said I had retreated into abstraction, the abstraction of chess. He was wrong, though, when he concluded I had been driven to it. You can be quite sure that I did it by choice. It was simply a matter of translating the contactual evidence into an equivalent idea system. I learned very rapidly that when they play a game, they abide by the rules. I know the rules of chess, but I did not know the rules of their game. They did not give me their rules. They simply permitted me to convey mine to them. I learned a little more slowly that, though their power to reach our minds is unheard of in any of the seven galaxies we know about, it still cannot take and use any but the ideas in the forefront of our consciousness. In other words, chess was a possibility. They could be forced to take a sacrificed piece, as well as being forced to lose one of their own. They extrapolate a sequence beautifully, but they can be outthought. So much for that. I beat them at chess. And by confining my efforts to the chessboard where I knew the rules and where they respected them, I was able to keep what we call sanity. Where you were disturbed because the port disappeared, I was not disturbed because the disappearance was not chess. You are wondering, of course, how they did what they did to us. I don't know, but I can tell you what they did. They empathize, that is, see through our eyes, feel with our fingertips, so that they perceive what we do. Second, they can control those perceptions, hang on a distortion circuit, as Ives would put it, between the sense organ and the brain. For instance, you'll find all our fingerprints all around the port control, where one after the other we punched the wall and thought we were punching the button. You're wondering, too, what I did to break their hold on us. Well, I simply believed what I knew to be the truth, that the ship is unharmed and unchanging. I measured it with a steel tape, and it was so. Why didn't they force me to misread that tape? They would have if I'd done that measuring first. At the start, they were in the business of turning every piece of pragmatic evidence into an outright lie. But I outlasted the test. When they'd finished with their whole arsenal of sensory lies, they still hadn't broken me. They then turned me loose like a rat in a maze to see if I could find the way out. And again, they abided by their rules. They didn't change the maze when at last I attacked it. Let me rephrase what I've done. I feel uncomfortable cast as a Superman. We five pedestrians faced some heavy traffic on a surface road. You four tried nobly to cross, deaf and blindfolded. You were all casualties. I was not. And it wasn't because I am stronger or wiser than you, but only because I stayed on the sidewalk and waited for the light to change. So we won. Now. Hoskins paused to wet his lips. He looked at his shipmates, each in turn, each for a long reflective moment. Again his gentle face showed the half-smile, the small shake of the head. He lifted the mic. In my chess game, I offered them a minor piece in order to achieve a victory, and they accepted. My interpretation is that they want me for further tests. This need not concern you on either of the scores which occur to you as you hear this. First, the choice is my own. It is not a difficult one to make. As Parisi once pointed out, I have a high idealistic quotient. Second, I am, after all, a very minor piece, and the game is a great one. I am convinced that there is no test to which they can now subject me and break me, that any one of you cannot pass. But you must in no case come tearing after me in a wild and thoughtless rescue attempt. I neither want that nor need it. And do not judge the natives severely. We are in no position to do so. I am certain now that whether I come back or not, these people will make a valuable addition to the galactic community. Good luck in any case. If the tests shouldn't prove too arduous, I'll see you again. If not, my only regret is that I shall break up what has turned out to be, after all, a very effective team. If this happens, tell my wife the usual things and deliver to her a letter you will find among my papers. She was long ago reconciled to eventualities. Johnny, the natives will fix your lighter. Good luck. Goodbye. Hoskins hung up the microphone. He took a stylus and wrote a line. Hear my recording, Pete. And then, bareheaded and unarmed, he stepped through the port, out into the golden sunshine. Outside he stopped, and for a moment touched his cheek to the flawless surface of the hull. He walked down into the valley. So it turns out it was all an alien test. We should have known. Or maybe we did. It all seemed rather Twilight Zone-ish to me, which really makes me think more of the 50s, although this was written, or published anyway, in 1972. But I like the way Hoskins figured it out. I did enjoy the insights into the captain and Parisi's characters. Those were unexpected depths. Especially, I did not expect the captain to be hitting the bottle like that and glorying in it. Well, when everything's all done, what the heck? Let's go for what we like, right? And we had a little hint as to why that might be at the very end. I am not exactly sure if I'm going to begin the Riddle of the Sands in the next episode, or possibly read a little bit of John Thorne in between. We haven't had any of him for a while. I'm going to look through there and see. Or maybe even an author highlight of somebody who I can't read all of. I don't know. We're just going to see what feels good. It will be a great surprise. I hope it'll be a great surprise. It will definitely be a surprise. I don't want to forget to say thank you to Jesse and Scott from SFF Audio. I never would have discovered Breaking Point if it weren't for their annual challenge. So there you go, guys. One more to knock off your list, and thank you very much. Other news, you remember a week or two, or well, probably 3 weeks ago by now, I mentioned that LibriVox was having to raise money for the first time in their history. I got an email last week. It said, wow, they made their goal in 2 weeks. It says, we raised $23,000 from 433 donors in 13 days, averaging $1,769 in donations from 33 people every day. We had a couple of big donors who gave a few thousand dollars each, and many more smaller donations, which all add up to everything we asked for. Thank you again. Instead, we'll get back to working hard to fulfill our mission, which is to make all books in the public domain available for free in audio format on the internet. And I say thank you, LibriVox, for that. They have enriched many hours of my listening time. And I find that heartwarming, too, that so many people gave so much money. I think that's fantastic. One new thing on the blog right now, if you never go by there, I have been quite remiss in responses to a plea for a list of books that I plan to read. So, I finally got to it. The post is called Books I'd Like to Read to You, and I've also linked to it in the sidebar so that we can easily find it when it's scrolled down into the archives more. There are not many that are definitely going to be read because I have a whole lot of them that I have to do some copyright research on. Again, if this is an area that you know anything about and you're interested in one of those books, please be my guest. Feel free. Help me. I don't need money. Okay, well, who doesn't? But for the podcast, I don't need money, but any help with that would be much appreciated. And I think you'll see otherwise, I do have plenty to read, so it's not like we're hurting. Also, another request from someone else, it's a little newer, so I haven't quite gotten to it yet, is for me to list my favorite LibriVox readers. Because I actually do have a list. I keep them written down next to my list of books that I want to read, so that if I'm looking for something from LibriVox and I don't have anything particular in mind, I go check out these people's pages and see what they've been reading. I will try to get to that in the next week or so. So if you see that pop up, that's why it's there. If you would like to see a list from me or leave a comment about this story or some other story or anything, really, go to the blog for the podcast, hcforgottenclassics.blogspot.com. And of course, you can leave a comment in the comments boxes. My email is in the sidebar there. And most of you know how to get to iTunes. You know how I crave those reviews. So do feel free, if you're in the mood. I have 30 reviews. And you'd think that would be enough, but somehow it just never is it? Eh, well. As always, I really appreciate everybody coming by to read the story. Leave me comments, send a little email, the Ravelry group, or just to know that your numbers are there and that the podcasts are being downloaded. The last ones have had about, over 3,000 downloads for each episode, which is rather staggering to me. I know that's a small number for some of the big boys, but I'm not a big boy. And I appreciate it, everyone. It makes it much more fun. Have a great week, and I'll talk to you again soon.